Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Welcome to the world, my wonderful listeners. I'm snowed in today in upstate New York, and I'm on a hard line. I don't have my usual technical connections to my wonderful engineer, Giselle, in New York City, but I think we'll do just fine. If we don't do fine, he'll interrupt, and you'll get to hear his voice. And my guest, Martin, I can hear you when you talk. I have really an interesting guest today who actually is one of the finest researchers in the entire field of psychiatry. But before I get to him and introduce you to him, first, my book is out, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions is out. I've done just a little bit of media, and it's already way ahead of all my other books on Amazon. It's growing pretty much on its own, and I think that's because the message is a positive one about how you can overcome the experiences that hold you back in life, the internal experiences, so that you can maximize your accomplishments, your satisfaction, your happiness. And around times of Christmas, of course, many people get sadder rather than happier. It can help you understand why. And, of course, we make New Year's resolutions and they fail, and it can help you understand why. This is a book that I've literally been working on for 40 or more years, and I put my heart and soul in it. You can get it on our website, Bregan.com, where we have a wonderful offer. It far exceeds any offer anybody else is going to make or that we've ever made. This is a $19 book. And we're selling it for $14 and giving you free the antidepressant fact book, which is worth just about as much money. So you're really getting two books for one because we really want to get guilt, shame, and anxiety out into the world. So if you go to Bregan.com, until we run out of antidepressant fact books, and that won't happen too soon because we bought up a whole bunch at a really good price, although it's still in print, you can get Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, and as a really good companion, the Antidepressant Fact Book. People are already buying four and five copies to give to friends for the holidays because it really is inspiring. Tonight will come the really big media event. We haven't had a big media event yet, just a few radio shows that weren't national. And tonight I'm going to be on George Norrie's Coast to Coast for 2 hours talking about guilt, shame, and anxiety. I love George Norrie. I'm his resident psychiatrist. I'll be talking to, maybe before those 2 hours are up, I'll probably have touched 20 million people. He's got a huge audience, 4 to 6 million at any one minute. And it goes on West Coast time at 10. I'll be on, and goes on for many hours, but I'll be on from 10 to 12 West Coast, 1 to 3 East Coast, 10 to 12 West Coast, 1 to 3 East Coast, talking about guilt, shame, and anxiety for a couple of hours with wonderful George Norrie on Coast to Coast. You can just Google Coast to Coast or use whatever search mechanism you prefer and find out where it is in your area. It is by far and away the dominant evening talk show in America. So talk to me, call in on George Norrie tonight. My guest today is Martin Harrow. I hope for many of you that rings a bell. Martin Harrow, H-A-R-R-O-W. He is a professor emeritus now, but he still works probably more than most folks at the Department of Psychiatry, University of Illinois, in the College of Medicine. And he's in Chicago now, and before I further introduce him, Martin, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, good. I'm always a little nervous when I don't have my usual communication system, and so everything is working out okay. Martin has an article out along with his colleagues, Drs. Job and Fall, F-A-U-L-L, who may be keeping him company right now. He's got a new article out, well, 2014, Does the Treatment of Schizophrenia with Antipsychotic Medications Eliminate or Reduce Psychosis? A 20-year multi-follow-up study. Dr. Harrow, who has been doing work in this field officially as a psychiatrist, probably as long or longer than I have, has a long, long follow-up series of studies he's doing on this subject, which is essentially the question, do antipsychotic drugs help people diagnosed with schizophrenia, or do they not? And he's done a lot of other work with other drugs, especially earlier in his career. But no one's done the quality of follow-up studies on this subject, this all-important subject, as he has. So, Dr. Martin Harrow, would you just kind of give us a summary of your work, how you got started in it? It goes on now for decades. And what's your finding?
Okay. First of all, let me just mention, to clarify, I'm a psychologist, not a psychiatrist.
Oh, you know what? I knew that, and I forgot. Yeah. Job is your psychiatrist.
He's a neuropsychiatrist,
a neuropsychiatrist. Thank you for the correction. I wish you were a psychiatrist. You see, that was Freud's wishful thinking.
I'm sure you mean it in a positive way, so I'll thank you for that.
Yeah. I wish I could say one of my colleagues who's a psychiatrist, not a psychiatrist, but is a psychiatrist who's doing this work. But, you know, of course, we don't do this work very much. So thank you for your existence, and thank you for the correction, and go on with what you want to say.
So what I've been doing, years ago when I first started in the field, I had several experiences working on inpatient units. That is, units that get new patients when they're quite young, and when they're just beginning, for those who are going to be disordered, they're just beginning to be disordered, and there were inpatient settings, which get some very severe cases. And I had always been interested in distorted thinking and strange thinking, and when many patients with schizophrenia have this kind of strange thinking. So that was one of the things that interested me, and then I began to study it. I studied their thinking, and then I was also interested in outcome, and I studied it over time in outcome, and I was fortunate eventually to getting some large grants from the National Institute of Mental Health to follow up and see do those patients who have strange thinking continue to have strange thinking, and those who have strange beliefs or delusions and other kinds of psychotic phenomena, do they continue to have it? So I studied them over time, and I've been very fortunate in being able to get grants from the National Institute of Mental Health, and even early on from the MacArthur Foundation and other sources. So fortunately, I've been able to follow up a fair-sized sample of patients with schizophrenia, with bipolar disorders, with unipolar depressive disorders, and a series of other patients. And I've been able to follow them. We've analyzed for 20 to 26 years, and we've analyzed the data, or most of the data, from the first 20 years and been writing it up. And in particular, more recently, we noticed that those patients who had been taking antipsychotic medication, or at least been prescribed antipsychotic medications for many, many years, we're not doing as well as the field seemed to think. Many of them were psychotic when they started taking them, these medications, and are still psychotic. So we began to compare those patients who were taking antipsychotic medications for the full 20 years, or at least were being prescribed them for the full 20 years, and those who had gone off them very early, usually, but we didn't get exact statistics on this, but usually the patients who went off the medications were doing it on their own. By that I mean they weren't being told you can go off your medications now. They were saying, I'd like to try it without it. When we look at the data on them in a number of different areas and concerning their thinking and their psychosis and other kinds of problems, they were doing more poorly. And now this isn't to say that someone on medications, if they immediately go off, suddenly will do well, because the medications can leave some after effects in the human brain. But basically, in a number of different areas, a large number of different areas, our patients off the medications were doing better. So that's the heart of at least some of our recent publications. Go ahead.
Marty, and we're talking again with Dr. Martin Harrow, PhD psychologist who's been doing research now for decades on this issue. What were your measurements for people doing better or worse? And
okay.
How were you collecting them, by phone, interview?
Okay. About a quarter to a third of them have moved away from the area, and those we get by, we have long phone interviews with them. But most of them are still in this area. I've been in Chicago now for 40 years, and most of them are still in Chicago. And what we've done is we've called them up and arranged meetings, and we have 3 to 4 hour sessions with them. At first, every 2.5 years, and now more recently, every 5 years. And more recently, our grants, our major grants, our largest grants, stopped since we've had over 30 years of funding from the National Institute of Mental Health. But we were able to get 20 years of data, and not one-shot data, but every few years data on them. And we examined their potential psychosis, their potential disorder in thinking. We measured how many are what we call recovered. Now, recovered doesn't automatically mean for a lifetime. I can't guarantee what my rest of my life is going to be like, and I can't guarantee for a patient what their life is going to be like. But we measured whether they were recovered for a full year, and we found that a much larger percentage of those who had gone off the antipsychotics had recovered for a full year, some for much longer, some for what could be a lifetime, but we don't know that. I can't guarantee the rest of their lives. But we looked at psychosis, strange thinking or thought disorder. We looked at how many were rehospitalized at each follow-up. How many had relapsed, or by relapse had new problems, how many had what some call negative symptoms. We measured what some have called the quality of life, and we also measured whether they were working and what kind of jobs they were working at and so forth. So we measured a broad range of symptoms, and life functioning kinds of issues, whether they had friends, whether they were getting along with their families, and so forth. So that was basically our model, and we did it for those who were in treatment and for those who had left treatment. The people who were not on medications, at least the schizophrenia patients who were not on medications, most had left treatment. Not all, but the great majority of them. And again, I'm not advocating that everyone leave treatment. I'm just saying that it's something that has to be thought about carefully. And this was part of the kind of follow-ups we did, including studying what kinds of treatment and whether they're on medications and what medications and even what doses.
Well, before we're done today, we will get into just what the implications are in terms of your opinion, my opinion, which
sure.
may differ on whether people shouldn't take these drugs to start with. Right mm-hmm. now, I want to keep filling out the facts from this amazing study. Now, if we look at, and I think people will be really interested in this, if we just look at what happens to people who don't take their meds, and then we'll look at what happens to people who do, if we look at people who end up within the first year or two or so saying, probably against their doctor's wishes, I'm sure in most cases, not all, I'm going to come off my meds, and they come off. Is there a rough percentage of what you could say about how are these people doing now, 20 years later? What percentage of them are doing well?
Of the ones who left, what we basically did is we divided up. This is among the schizophrenia patients and the ones who had.
When you say the schizophrenia patients, there's an implication of some other group. And what's the other group?
Oh, well, the other large group we had, well, there's two other large groups. The large psychotic group who didn't have what we call schizophrenia were patients who were bipolar patients who were psychotic when they first came to the hospital, and patients with unipolar depression who were psychotic when they first came to the hospital.
So let's talk about that and maybe even in the second half of our hour, okay?
Sure.
Just focusing on the schizophrenic patients, which is the subject of a lot of your articles,
mm-hmm.
How'd they do, the ones who didn't take their drugs? Can you say a third of them were sounded pretty normal or make some general statement about it that would be useful?
Let me first explain. What we did, one of the ways we looked at it statistically was we divided the sample of schizophrenia, of patients with schizophrenia, into three groups. Those who had been continuously prescribed antipsychotics for 20 years or more. The second group was those who had been on and off and on and off the medications. And the third group was those who had left it early on in the first few years, left their antipsychotics and had not gone back on them for the full 20 years. Okay, so you're asking, what about those? It's a smaller group. It's only about 15 patients who had gone off it and stayed off it for 20 years, or at least since we our first follow-up of them. We had studied them intensively when they were in the hospital. We had given them all sorts of interviews.
Is that about 10% of your patients, roughly, 8 or 10%?
The ones who...
Who left early on?
It was a higher percentage. It was about 15 patients who left it and stayed off it throughout.
Of the
schizophrenia patients who we followed up for most of the first 20 years, it's about 25%, a little more.
Okay, great. So it's not such a small percentage of your study.
And no.
So how do you rate them for us, those who left early on?
Okay. As a group, they were doing much better. Some of them, as a there were very few who had, there was actually none, or maybe one who was psychotic through, who still had some psychotic symptoms throughout the 20 years, but that was rare. That was only one patient, and most of the others had one or two psychotic episodes along the way during the 20 years, but that was it. They didn't have more. And now keep in mind that it's hard, and actually you're the expert on this, not us, that it's hard, even if a patient decides to go off by himself or herself, it's hard to go off them. The antipsychotics leave some, as many other medications, and medications in other areas too, this is not unique to psychiatry, after taking something for a long time, it sometimes gets harder, at least with many medications, to go off them. And that's not just a phenomenon with antipsychotics.
Yeah, I think it's from brain damage, literally, that you become more and more aware as you come off the medicine about how injured you are. And it's more than just withdrawal. It's a lasting injury.
Okay.
But you're saying, and this is spectacular, you're saying that at the 20-year mark, that actually only one patient of this group had psychotic symptoms.
No, had psychotic symptoms throughout the full 20 years.
Okay.
About,
and the rest then had episodically, well, at the 20-year follow-up, how many were symptom-free? Do you have that fact?
I do.
You can ask Bob if he's there.
I'm not sure, actually.
Okay. I would say the majority of them were symptom-free. And that
the majority of symptoms, okay.
Were symptom-free. Some were having, but it was only a few of them. Some were having trouble with work, with their work functioning. But most of them were, the surprising thing, one of the most surprising things, and we haven't completed the write-up on this yet, is that many of the people, the great majority of the people who went off the antipsychotics were working 20 years later and had been working much of the time during those 20 years, whereas many patients who are on antipsychotics are not working effectively, are not working at all. And the difference there was about 80% of those off antipsychotics were working, and only about 15%, 20% of those who were on antipsychotics were working. Now, when I say working, I mean working at least half time. We have to set some criteria, so we set half time, working at least half time. As the criteria. It could have been any other criteria. We have the data for that, but it's not one uniform package. Some were working three-quarter time, some were working full time, and some were working only half time. So
these are people in their 40s, 50s?
They're people in their, by the 20-year follow-up, we caught them fairly young. About almost half of them were the first time they'd ever been admitted to a psychiatric hospital. So about half of our sample were new, first, what some would call first admission patients. So of those patients, a lot of them were working, a surprising percentage, and of those on medications, very few were working. What happens is the problem was that many of the patients on medications, it didn't completely stop their psychosis. So they were having, and many of them were having cognitive problems. And there's also what some would call negative symptoms. And what negative symptoms really refer to is people who are slowed down, and perhaps the primary thing is they don't have as much drive and motivation. And that's a hard one to measure, by the way, so it's not a precise measurement. A lot of people have studied these so-called negative symptoms, but to work, if you already have had some problems, you often need to be, in a sense, driven to work. By driven, to have something in you that tells you that you want to do this and you want to do it badly, or want to do it to a high degree.
Yeah. And now, I suspect, Marty, that that's due to two things, you know, at least two things. One is the fact that's the primary effect of antipsychotic drugs, is to knock out the energy system and the drive, motivation. But the other, I think, is that over the years, people get so injured by the drugs, they get apathy and indifference as a part of shrinkage of their brains, too. So I suspect there's both brain damage and the direct effect of the drugs are doing that. We can talk more about that and see what your views are after the break. We've got about 1 minute before we go to break. Let me ask you a question that may be on people's minds. Is there a continuum between the people who are on the drugs most of their lives, the people who have been on and off, and the people who left early, in that in general, the on and off are doing better than the people who are on them their whole lives but not doing as well as people who came off them?
In one sense, continuums are tricky things, but in one sense there is. The people who were on and off and on and off and back and forth are not doing anywhere near as well as those who were completely off it for 20 years or 18 years. But they're not, in general, some are doing poorly, but many of them were somewhere between the group completely on it and completely off it. By completely on it, completely prescribed it. Some of those prescribed it for 20 years are getting the prescriptions and not taking it, but many are taking it.
Yeah. We're going to go to break now.
Okay.
I'm talking with Martin Harrow, and helping him out in the background is Dr. Faull, F-A-U-L-L, who is a statistician and whose name appears on this recent article and on others, I'm sure, as well. And I appreciate having him in the background. And I think this is an incredibly valuable show. I hope my listeners are glued and will tell their friends about it. And right now we'll go to a break and come back and continue just delving into what we're learning from all of this. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin, returning with one of the most important guests I've ever had on the show, Martin Harrow, psychologist, professor emeritus in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Illinois in Chicago, and who is telling us about his 20-year study of the effects of antipsychotic drugs or their relative absence on the course of people diagnosed with schizophrenia. Dr. Harrow, one of the things, let me just start out. Is there anything left out that you want to mention? Because I have plenty of places to go in asking you questions, but I'd just like to know, I think the show is going extremely well, and I just want to know if there's anything in particular you want to add to our conversation so far.
No. See, we've covered multiple, our research has covered multiple aspects, and in a program like this, we only have time for some of them, but you may, in a sense, have a better feel for what kinds of things you're interested.
Yeah, well, that's good. First, I had a very interesting question. I don't know how many other people are just champing at the bit for this one. Why do you think NIMH has cut your funding off? Do you think your results just don't fit with their goals in life?
The funding partly, see, we've been studying schizophrenia and bipolar disorders and more routine depressive disorders, and one of their priorities was, in truth, that we still don't have an exact picture in modern times of what the long-term course over decades is of schizophrenia or even of bipolar disorders and of regular...
Why do you think, though, at this point they didn't say this is the most important study going on? I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot, and can be a little too aggressive sometimes, but I suspect that they just don't like the results because this is like the most important study I could imagine that's going on right now. And the 20-year follow-up is incredible, and it would have been best to just follow this up as long as possible. I'm hugely disappointed that they're not funding. Are you going to be able to do continued follow-ups?
We do not have the funding. The follow-up stopped about 4 or 5 years ago simply because we didn't have the funding for it. And part of their reasoning is they're worried that they're giving... One of their reasons is that this is a priority area, finding what the long-term course of schizophrenia is. In some ways, it's almost ridiculous that we've had schizophrenia around for such a long time, and yet we still don't know what the long-term course is. It's entirely possible, but there's no evidence one way or the other, that after a while that... Some disorders, when you reach your 40s or 50s or 60s, begin to go away. Some don't. It's possible that that happens with some schizophrenia patients or not, and that would be one of the issues. But there may have been some worry. There's a greater biological emphasis, and there may have been some worry that they were spending too much money on our longitudinal...
I don't think so. I think... I know those guys. I think they didn't like these results. And the results are stunning. From my own clinical experience, people have complete recoveries over the years. Many, many people, if you go back to Bleuler's earliest books, before there were treatments that were inflicted for a lifetime on these people, he pointed out that schizophrenia was not a deteriorating disorder unless you were abused in state mental hospitals. Then you had head injuries and trauma and malnutrition and you had an early death. But that other folks, in fact, who had that label often recovered fully over the years. He was very, very clear about that. And we've known... People who have been thoughtful have known this clinically since the beginning of our diagnosing people, and shame on the federal government for pulling the rug out from under you. I know you wouldn't say that, but shame on them.
Let me just add something to it. As far as whether schizophrenia is a deteriorating disorder, that clearly it isn't, at least for most schizophrenia patients. It is not a deteriorating disorder. The question is, does it stay stable or even get a little better over time? And we don't have the final data on because we weren't able to continue following them, but it's clearly not a deteriorating disorder for the great majority of schizophrenia patients.
Yeah. And physical disorders of the brain are mostly deteriorating disorders. This is another way in which, in my opinion, it's clearly not a physical disorder. What are your thoughts on that? I'm sure folks would be interested in your thoughts on what do you think the research is overall, not just your own, is telling us about whether so what I would say is so-called schizophrenia is a medical biochemical disorder or not.
Okay. One of the things that many people in the field tell patients is that they're taking medications because some of the biochemical they have a shortage or of some of the biological connections and so forth, or the biochemical they lack certain biochemical substances and so forth, and they're taking the antipsychotic medications, and similarly for depression, somewhat similarly, they're taking them to make up for these biochemical shortages. It's still possible that that's the case, but for the most part, up to now, there's been like 60 years of evidence, and they still, if there is a shortage in the brain of certain biochemical features, it has not been found consistently in schizophrenia or even in depression.
Or anywhere, really, in what we call psychiatric disorders.
Right. So it's still possible, by the way, but it's a guess, and it's not, the evidence doesn't favor it. The evidence is neutral on it, and it's certainly been searched for a long time, and it hasn't been found. It's still possible, but we don't know the real cause, and the other thing that's most likely is that it's not one cause, but 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 different things which are coming together, and that if you only have 3 or 4 of those 8 causes, that isn't enough to make you ill. But if you have 7 of the 8 or something like that, but that's still a guess. But I'm just saying that the biochemical theory that we lack certain biochemical substances, that has not worked out so far. It still could in the future, but so far it hasn't. And those who assure you that you're taking this because you're taking an antidepressant because you don't have enough serotonin in your system or something like that, well, it's still possible, but they've been searching for the various dopamine, various kinds of biochemical substances. They haven't found a shortage yet. It's a possibility, but it's when people say it, they say it with a little more hushed breath because they don't have the evidence to back it up.
I would say clinically that when you work, as I do work with some very, disturbed patients. My colleagues like to imagine I don't, many of them who favor the drugs. They think I just work with, I don't know with whom, but actually I work with a lot of very distressed human beings and have since I was 18 years old volunteering in a state mental hospital and with a program that we created that got back ward patients out of the hospital when we were literally just practically children at Harvard. But my clinical experience is that people who have disorders that get psychiatrically labeled, that when you get to know them and talk with them, they are very different than people with any kind of known brain injury. That is, they're perfectly capable of rational thought. They're perfectly capable of making calculations. They're perfectly capable of having periods of time and sometimes completely growing toward periods of time when they're totally normal and by anybody's judgment about what their thinking processes are like. And that this is a big difference between somebody who has Alzheimer's or some other form of dementia or head injury, that it just is totally different. That, in fact, to be able to elaborate the kinds of imaginings that people have who are very disturbed, you have to have a very good mind, very good imagination. You have to be very poetic, and it takes brain damage to stop that. And when we give people shock treatment drugs, they give up that. They don't have the frontal lobe capacity anymore. And it's also my experience that if you get to know the family life of people who become psychotic in their teens and early 20s, it's very obvious that the whole process is within the family life of the individual. That marvelous group in Finland that the open dialogue people say that, quote, schizophrenia lies in between the family members. And I think we have more evidence than you're suggesting that, in fact, schizophrenia can be treated entirely without drugs, as they do for most patients there, as I do in my own practice, and as Soteria, Hauslaw, and Mosier just showed with most, the vast majority of their patients. But it sure is wonderful to have your research. Do you want to briefly, we have 15 minutes left of the program or less, a little less even, about what you've been learning about the following bipolar, people labeled bipolar and people labeled with depressive disorders?
Okay. By the way, in addition to the sample we've been reporting on recently, we did study... Most people with depression are not psychotic, and we did study over the 20 years a large sample also of depressives who were bad enough to be in bad enough shape to be hospitalized, but were not psychotic, and they did better than the patients who were psychotic than the depressives who were psychotic, but I guess. In relation to medications, when I started in the field, there had just been a series of articles showing how lithium seemed to cure all bipolar patients, or almost all bipolar patients. And that we studied about some many years ago. We studied that hypothesis, and it didn't work out. Namely, there were some patients who were on lithium who did well, but a number of patients on lithium didn't do well. And by the way, later, a more common medication is Depakote for people who are bipolar, who have mood swings, drastic ones, up and down, who get drastically over-elated and drastically depressed. And those are the bipolar patients. And our research, but this was many years ago, and we haven't gone back to look at it much, our research indicated that the people not on any medications did about as well as the bipolar patients. There were a series of publications in the early 1990s by us, and a little later on, and even a book, an edited book, by another colleague of mine who was a psychiatrist and myself, where one of the questions we posed to some of the leading people studying bipolar disorders is why they were no longer doing better. Why the people on lithium were no longer doing better. And it may be some of the early reports were just wrong, were just miscalculations. But we can't say... See, with the schizophrenia patients, it's clear that those on medications, on antipsychotics for a long time, are doing more poorly, at least in our studies, and that those not on it were doing better, whereas with the bipolar patients, the ones on lithium and the ones not on lithium were doing about even. And it may be, in fairness to lithium, that the patients who were worse off were put on lithium, and then they did that made up the difference, whereas many of them weren't doing that well. There may have been the patients who were most vulnerable to psychopathology who were on lithium. But
my own impression, Marty, is that there have been a lot more studies since then, VA studies, and that the lithium does not reduce manic episodes, and furthermore, that we now get lithium withdrawal. People get manias. A number of studies now that manic episodes occur abruptly after stopping lithium, and that this is not this is because of the withdrawal. And we do know now that, as we should have known from the beginning, that this drug has lithium has a very deteriorating effect on the brain, and that people are developing terrible disorders. One has an acronym, SILENT, S-I-L-E-N-T, for just neurological dilapidation. I review those studies in the first half of Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, if people want to look for the science. The first half of Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal looks at the long-term adverse effects of every category of drug.
Another aspect to be considered is that if you look at very old textbooks on bipolar disorders, most of the old textbooks will describe patients who at the age of, say, 25 years had a bipolar episode, and then 15 years later, at the age of 40, had a second one, and then another 20 years later,
that's right,
had a third one.
Yeah.
Whereas
yeah.
Nowadays, and maybe those reports were false, but they were done by careful clinicians.
Hey, listen, you and I are both old enough to have seen that.
That was
what we expected.
And nowadays, a lot of people with bipolar disorders seem to get a new episode every other year or something like
well,
that.
Well, and daily, we've now got that multi-cycling. It's all medication-induced, I believe. These drugs are so toxic. I mean, we know that lithium substitutes for the basic elements of potassium, sodium, and in the neuronal process of neurotransmission. It's terrible for the brain, I think. What about your data on the people who had psychotic depressions, and they were getting medication? Do you have a comparison on medication and non-medication there?
We haven't really looked at that carefully of medication, non-medication. We've looked at those with psychotic depression and compared them to those who were depressed but not psychotic, and we have the belief from our data, actually, and I think we've published a few papers in the American Journal of Psychiatry on this, that people who are psychotically depressed are just more vulnerable to psychosis. So when they get depressed, they have a somewhat greater chance of becoming psychotic. Now, do the medications play a role? I don't know. That we haven't really looked at carefully. So I can't
say.
Well,
we do know that, you know, the way I would look at it, I'm a simple guy, is that if your disturbance is really greater than somebody else's disturbance, you may have more trouble recovering. So that if you're depressed and you also are deluded into believing you're being poisoned by your wife, and presumably she's not poisoning you, but you have that idea that, you know, you're just even more distressed, and of course it's going to be harder for you to recover. But we now know that a huge proportion of what's called bipolar is drug-induced. I mean, there are studies that one-third of hospital admissions, are psychoses caused by antidepressants. So what we're seeing now is so different. When I was young, and I want to, you know, I mean, is this true for you too? When I was in my training, we would see maybe at an acute treatment center at Harvard or at the Upstate Medical Center, which were the two in New York, the two treatment centers I trained in, acute ones, that we might see a bipolar patient once or twice a year, maybe three times, and it was a big event, and we held a grand rounds. But that now we're seeing it all the time, and it's not just because of the overinflation of the diagnosis, which is part of it. It's because stimulants, and in particular antidepressants, are creating terrible these bipolar phenomena. And then when you treat people with the drugs like lithium, they continue cycling. What's your impression when you were a youngster? Did you see many bipolar patients in a year of treatment in a treatment facility?
Well, we were getting when I was young. I was at Yale New Haven Hospital. I was on the faculty at Yale.
Yeah.
We were getting a certain percentage of bipolar patients.
What year are you talking about?
I'm talking about I started in the field in the early 60s, 1960s, a long time ago.
So do you think at Yale New Haven you saw more than a few patients who were genuinely what we used to call manic depressive, having extreme highs and extreme lows, and who were really out of it? Do you think you were seeing more than a few a year at the treatment center?
I honestly don't remember, and we weren't keeping close track. We also had some outpatient clinics for them, but whether they were really bipolar patients or just people with moderately severe ups and downs, I don't know. But we had some outpatient clinics there that were very good, and we had a doctor, John Himmelhock, who was very good in this area, but may have been, well, I don't know. He was a psychiatrist who was very good.
Now, did you work with LIDS, LIDZ, and other folks at Yale who were doing all this wonderful work on how mental disorders had family roots and even economic and poverty roots?
Yes, he was even my chairman for a year at one point.
Yeah. Boy, that psychiatry changed since then. You couldn't be chairman and do research on family and economic origins, because poverty, believe it or not, is worse for people and tends to make people more upset and more vulnerable to what we call mental illnesses, and so does distress in the family.
So
Not terribly complicated.
I didn't actually do clinical. I was doing a lot of clinical work at that time. I didn't work clinically with Ted Litz, but we had discussion groups, because he certainly was very interested in the causes of schizophrenia and of bipolar disorders and other disorders.
Yeah.
And he was a good theorist, and we had discussion groups of seven or eight people who were also interested in what might cause these things. And a number of us had a lot of clinical experience. We were seeing a lot of patients. So I did work with Litz quite a bit.
You know, Marty, I got in for my residency. I got into both Harvard and Yale. And I went to Harvard because they had these great family programs that I thought were going to be and psychological programs. And the next year when I went there, they totally changed the program into pharmacology overnight. It was just a political decision, nothing to do with science. I probably would have been happier if I'd gone to Yale, because back then they still did have some degree of a humanitarian, caring, the psychotherapeutic, family-oriented program, although I don't imagine it's much there now.
That they did. And let me mention, you mentioned Lauren Moshe, who started Soteria House. When I was there at Yale, he was there also. In other words, he was on the faculty at Yale for a period before he went over.
What a great faculty it must have been. We're finishing up now, folks. This has been, I hope, a really enlightening hour for people. I hope you'll tell your friends about it and download it. My guest, Martin Harrow, who has been doing the longest term, most scientific follow-up studies on what really happens to folks with serious diagnoses when they're given drugs. And in the area of schizophrenia, it's very, very clear that the folks are doing better who have released medications. Thank you so much for being on the show today.